I love this passage because there's so much. It's so rich. And for me, this passage was actually life-changing. And it's you might not notice it, but there's so much here that's just waiting to be like delved into and mined to understand better. Now, some of you might find that a bit discouraging, and I understand that, because we often want the Bible to just be like easy to understand. Boom, boom, boom. Just read it, and like this is what it means. We want it to mean what it seems like it means, right? And sometimes, though, unfortunately, there's work for us to do, right? To best understand the words that were written to like a different culture at a different time. And that's what this passage is like. There's amazing stuff here, but we need to work for it, all right? And what isn't often apparent to us from the words that Carlise just read to us in this passage is that this is very much about this passage, about one of the chief objectives of God to bring all people in the world together. All different ethnicities, races, colors coming together under one banner of Yahweh. Right? Now, that might be news to some of us. Maybe you didn't know that about God's plan for this world. All right? What does the Bible have to do with people coming together, we might ask? What role does the church play in bringing about reconciliation and restoration between racial groups? In fact, for many of us, and sadly, many people outside the church, we may think that the church is flat out against reconciliation between races. After all, as Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. noted some decades ago, 11 a.m. on Sunday morning is the most segregated hour of the week. And that fact hasn't changed too much over the past 60 years. Moreover, the white church in America has often stood on the sidelines while our brothers and sisters of color have experienced a very different America. So what does it all have to do with me and my life, my story? Well, I grew up in a church that was all white. Shocker, right? Actually, for most of us that grew up in the church, our story is probably the story of people who grew up in a church that was somehow segregated, right? Sometimes that's just the reality of where we live. More than half the people in this country are white, so if you do the math, yeah, there's going to be a lot of towns and a lot of churches that have like only white people. You don't have to feel guilty about that. But the monoethnic reality of the church is what most of us have experienced, really, no matter where we grew up. And we usually don't think about that too much, do we? Certainly I didn't when I was growing up. When I was in college, I met a Korean man who had a huge influence and impact on my life. And he had a particular vision for a multi-ethnic church. I had never heard of anything like that, a multi-ethnic church. All right? And so 20 years ago, there really weren't many of those around. And it sounded to me like a pretty amazing idea. In fact, before I had even heard of that idea, my heart was moved by a desire to see people come together. When I was 10 years old, my parents moved from our home in Chicago, Illinois, to a small town in Boardman, Ohio. So you probably heard of one of those cities and never heard of another one of them. So all I had really known up until that point as I was growing up was a diverse, multicultural, urban context in one of the most diverse cities in the world. But all of a sudden, I found myself in a very monocultural context of small, suburban Ohio. My mom laughed at me when I got home after that first day of school, and I came home, I said to my mom, I said, "Mom, all the kids in the school are white." That was strange for me. But on Sunday morning, when I walked into an all-white church, which I had been doing every day for my whole life, that was completely normal. Monoethnic churches were the norm. And when you walk into most churches across Quincy, Boston, New England, the rest of this country, you're going to find churches that are filled with people who look the same as one another. People who come from the same walks of life, who pay taxes in the same tax bracket. So when this Korean guy came up to me in college and said to me, "I want you to help me start a church that's going to be multi-ethnic," my ears perked up because something in my life experience said, yes, that I think that that's how the church should be. If possible, whenever, we should be together. As I would come to learn, as we'll see in a passage like the one that we're looking at today, that's actually what God's intent is. Now, to be clear from the outset, this isn't something that we care about because it's cool to care about this. It's too easy for us to virtue signal about race and diversity and things like that. But we don't have to do that. It's not our idea in the first place. It's God's idea. We care about these kind of things because God cares about it. So we don't embrace diversity because we like the way it sounds and the way it makes us feel when we say it. No. We embrace this. We embrace nations coming together because Christ died so that all people could be reconciled both to God and to each other. Jesus wants us to be together. And sadly, in the church, it's very uncommon. And in a community like Boston, we have so much opportunity to do church and to do life together. But it's never easy, is it? And it wasn't easy when Jesus was around either. So if you have your Bibles with you this morning, we're going to walk through the verses of this passage. And my hope is that you might be moved as well as this has moved me in my life. Mark chapter 11, beginning at verse 12. Now, before we kind of dive into the text itself, we need to understand the context a little bit, okay? So can we talk a little bit just about Jewish history and what it means to be a Jew at that time? Okay, we know that Jesus was Jewish, right? Right? Like we're all on that same page, right? And for the Jews, everything in worship revolved around the temple in Jerusalem. The temple was the centerpiece of their worship. It meant everything. It was where they met with God, with Yahweh. It was where they sacrificed. It was where they sang and celebrated. Men and women and children would travel on foot for days and weeks just to worship at the temple in Jerusalem. The temple was the place where they recaptured the idea of Eden, a glimpse of Eden from all the way back at the beginning of Genesis. It was a place where heaven overlapped with earth. And that's why we sing today, like they did even before Jesus was born. Better is one day in your courts. Better is one day in your house. Better is one day in your courts than thousands elsewhere. As far as the people of God were concerned, the temple of the Lord was the place where the God who created everything lived on earth. And we see evidence of that when we look at the Old Testament. King Solomon, when they first dedicated the temple, the first temple, there were a few, right? The first temple that was dedicated by Solomon, and here's what happened. It's a beautiful scene in 2 Chronicles. It says, when Solomon finished praying, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of the Lord filled the temple. The priests could not enter the temple of the Lord because the glory of the Lord filled it. When all the Israelites saw the fire coming down and the glory of the Lord above the temple, they knelt on the pavement with their faces to the ground and they worshiped. Which is a pretty appropriate response to like the presence of God just dropping in one spot. Absolutely amazing. They worshiped. This was the dwelling place of God. So when Jesus went to worship, he went to the temple. But here's the thing that you need to know about the temple in Jerusalem. It was not a multiculturally friendly place. In fact, it was starkly segregated and exclusive. I think for us to really understand the significance of how temple worship worked, it's helpful for us to look at the way that the temple was designed. So I'm going to walk us through a few pictures that we're going to put up on the screen. And if we see how the temple is physically designed, we might better understand some of the broken things that started happening in this place. So let's start with I think we've got a picture of the temple there. Thanks, Hugh. So there's like a model of the temple, of what it looked like. And what do you notice about that? There's like a lot of walls, right? All right? And those walls weren't unimportant, but they came to start to mean something. All right? So let's take it. I've got another shot from just like above. This is what it would look like from above. And there's all these different courts. All right? And the yellow are these walls that divided people. Okay? And if you see over there on the left, you see what's called the Gentile court. All right? And the very middle, up at the top there, you see there? It says most holy place. That's the place where like God's presence dwelled, right? And then there was the main temple, and then there was the court of the priests, and the court of Israel with Jewish men, and then there was the court of the women, and the court of the Gentiles. All right, so why don't we go to the next slide? And this is the what we call the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall of the temple. This is all that remains of like the base of where the temple was. It was like where this like wall kind of held up where the temple was. If you want to ask, like talk to people who are actually there and they'll give you a real, a better description. Mike Chu was just there a few weeks ago and so he's a good person to talk to about this. But even today, there are dividing walls that separate people, okay? So go to the next slide, Hugh, and here we see, this was uncovered by archaeologists several years ago, and this was an inscription that was placed in the court of the Gentiles before entering into the inner courts of the temple. And that inscription in Greek, so that foreigners could read it and understand it, Greek was like the common language that they all shared in the first century, it says this: "No foreigner may enter beyond the dividing wall into the court around the holy place. Whoever is caught will have only himself to blame for his death, which will follow." Whoa. Hey, can you imagine if we had a sign outside our church that said, "Only Chinese people welcome," or "Only white people welcome"? That would be crazy, right? I don't think we can be reminded enough that it was really only about 60 years ago when African Americans weren't welcomed in many churches in the South and throughout this country. It wasn't that long ago when Chinese weren't welcomed in churches in California and New York City and even Boston. That's the religious climate in which Jesus worshiped. It was monocultural. It did not welcome the world around it. It did not reach out to the world around it. But Jesus was passionate about all people worshiping God together. That's what captivated and moved me when I read this passage that we're looking at this morning. Now, this idea that Jesus has, some of us hear Jesus, we're like, wow, Jesus was so progressive, he was way ahead of his time. No, Jesus is actually dialing it way back to what God's original intent was. We'll talk a little bit about that. So here's a helpful way to understand the structure of this passage that we're looking at. Understanding the structure of ancient documents like this can help us with understanding the meaning. So we can understand this almost like a three-act play, okay? Act one, Jesus curses the fig tree. Act two, Jesus flips out in the temple. All right, we'll try to figure that out. Act three, Jesus and his disciples see the fig tree again, and this time it's withered, all right? So this is how, by the way, Mark writes most of his gospel, like these sections of three. And throughout the book of Mark, we see these groups of three where there are two elements that are bookending something important happening in the middle, something that we're meant to focus on and understand better. And we see that here. We've got the fig tree up front, then the fig tree comes up again. That should alert the reader, something's happening in between the fig tree that we need to pay attention to. Okay? And so that's what we need to do. So let's break down what's happening here. Act 1, verses 12 through 14. All right, and just, you can go ahead and keep this up, Hugh. So the next day, as they were leaving Bethany, Jesus was hungry, seeing in the distance a fig tree in leaf. He went to find out if it had any fruit. When he reached it, he found nothing but leaves, because it was not the season for figs. Then he said to the tree, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." and his disciples heard him say it. So, and can we be honest? This is not the kind of verse that you memorize, right? In fact, it might not move you at all. But let's kind of pick it apart at the same time and try and figure out what's going on here. And this is where some of us might feel the weight of interpreting a 2,000-year-old book, okay? And that's what this is, all right? Because we're not necessarily clued in to all the nuances of what's happening in this text. But for a first century reader, they were clued in to what's happening as they're hearing this for the first time. They don't have to do the hard work of interpreting an ancient document because they're ancient people. It was meant for them. So we need to do our best to get in the heads of a first century Jewish hearer of the word. And when they would have heard Jesus talk about the fig tree, when they would have heard in Mark's community this being read to them, they would have heard about a fig tree, and they would have known what we probably fail to see, which is this, that the fig tree is a symbol for Israel, right? If you don't see that, if you don't hear that, if you don't understand that, then the meaning of the rest of this passage can be lost altogether, right? But if you do know that, then it's like having the key, all right? And so now we've got a key to get through one of the doors to understand this better. So Jesus and his disciples, they're walking along, and they see a fig tree. Ding, 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 ding. Right? But what's going on with this fig tree that Jesus notices? Something is not happening. It's not bearing any fruit, right? All right. Now, perhaps not a big deal because the text even notes it's not the season for figs. But that doesn't seem to be the point. Jesus curses the fig tree, saying, "May no one ever eat from you again." And he made sure that the disciples heard it. So here we've got an indictment and a curse. The fig tree, Israel, is not bearing fruit. In other words, Israel is not living up to who God created and sent them to be in the world. But what specifically is the fruit that Israel is failing to produce? It feels super random, doesn't it? And Jesus kind of drops it, and then the passage just moves on. It's like, this was very random, feels very random. And then it moves on to Act 2, if you will. But we're not done with the fig tree, are we? Right? We'll get to Act 2, but let's skip ahead to Act 3, because then we get to see the fig tree again. It says, in the morning, so this is the next day, as they went along, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots. Peter remembered, and he said to Jesus, "Rabbi, look, the fig tree you cursed has withered." So now we've got our two acts, Act 1 and 3, bookending something happening in the middle. It's like a theological sandwich, if you will. And what we find in the middle is like the meat that we're eating here. Like, this is what helps us understand what's going on and what's so important here. So we know Jesus is talking about Israel. It's like a metaphorical cursing of the nation of Israel, which sounds pretty serious. Not because, by the way, not because God hates Israel. On the contrary, God loves Israel deeply, deeply. Jesus came out of the nation of Israel. These are his people, right? But something has gone sideways for Israel, right? And the gospel is helping its readers to understand what that thing is that they're missing, that they need to be all about. So we've got the fig tree on one side. We've got the cursed, withered fig tree on the other side. What's happening in the middle? Well, in the middle, Jesus, like, flips his lid, all right? So what's going on with that? Because this also doesn't seem like the kind of Bible verse that you might memorize. Remember, we have, you know, the bread. You know, we've got the bread of our theological sandwich to help us out. We know that whatever's happening in the middle has something to do with Israel. In particular, it has something to do with the fruit that God's people are failing to produce. So after Jesus makes this big scene, he doesn't let an opportunity pass them by. He teaches them. Right? He's been flipping over the tables of the money changers and those who were selling doves, and then he teaches them. Look what he says. He says, "Is it not written, 'My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations,' but you have made it a den of robbers." Now, remember what we said earlier about the temple. This is the centerpiece of Israelite worship. But it had become a place of segregation. Not just in the way it was divided, but in the way that the foreigner was treated. They were taken advantage of in the changing of money, in the sale of animals for sacrifice. And specifically, here it mentions the sale of doves. Now, the sale of doves, would have been the sacrifice of choice for who? The poor people, right? Jesus says, no. My house. Those are bold words, by the way, are they not? Like, we sing, better is one day in your courts. Like, Jesus sings, better is one day in my courts, right? This is his house. And what does he say? My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. So there it is, right there. That's the glaring failure of Israel. They were meant to be a light to the nations, a blessing to the nations. That was the clear charter from all the way back to their father Abraham, to be a blessing to all nations, not a curse. Incidentally, by the way, this is why we need four gospels. Sometimes we're like, why do we have four and they're kind of different and I don't get that? Every single one of the four gospels has the same account of Jesus clearing the temple. But Mark is the only one of the four gospels that finishes the sentence here. The other gospels say, my house will be called a house of prayer, period. But Mark is actually finishing the quote from Isaiah chapter 56. And so if you'll indulge me, I'll read more of it from Isaiah so that we can truly grasp what the intent was from way back, even centuries before. God's people should have understood this is what we should be about, all right? So this is what it says in Isaiah. It says in verse 6 of chapter 56, and foreigners who bind themselves to the Lord to minister to him, to love the name of the Lord, and to be his servants, all who keep the Sabbath without desecrating it, and who hold fast to my covenant. Just so we're like all on the same page here. Isaiah is talking about Gentiles, non-Israelite Gentiles who love God, who love the one and only Creator God. And then in verse 7, what happens? The voice changes here. That happens a lot in the prophets. Like, so the voice changes here from the prophet's voice to the voice of the Lord. And it says, these I will bring to my holy mountain. Right, now, in case you didn't know, God's temple built on a mountain, a holy mountain called Mount Zion, right in the middle of Jerusalem. Like Jerusalem is like on this mountain, and that's where the temple was. They call it the Temple Mount or Mount Zion. So these, the Lord says, these I will bring, that is, these foreigners, I will bring to my holy mountain and give them joy in my house of prayer. Their burnt offerings and sacrifices will be accepted on my altar. For my house, he says, will be called a house of prayer for all nations. That's where Mark is quoting. That's where Jesus is quoting, right? My house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. So, the Gospel of Mark does not rob us of the end of that sentence. Jesus says, my house will be called a house of prayer for all nations. Now, I know, this is like a fire hose. How's everybody doing? You okay? All right. This is a lot to take in, but the Bible is amazing. And there's so much good to uncover when we just do a little bit of work. So, Israel has dropped the ball, right? Israel hasn't been the blessing to the nations that it was supposed to be, and Jesus is calling them out. Now, what does this mean for us? Well, before we wrap up, we need to look at the final verses of this passage. Verses that we might also struggle to understand, but maybe verses that we're much more likely to like highlight in our Bible and memorize, right? So the whole scene in the temple goes down. Side note, verse 18, like after this whole thing happens with Jesus, like Jesus flipping out, Jesus saying, my house is supposed to be a house of prayer for all nations. After this happens, do you notice what the priests and the teachers of the law do? They start looking for a way to kill him. This is like the most angry that we've ever seen Jesus, and he just goes nuts. So, we go back through the Gospels, and if we were to do that and look at all the Gospels, we should probably write down all the times in the Gospels when the enemies of Jesus decide, you know what, I think that we are going to kill him. And what we'll probably find are several spots where they decide to kill him when Jesus is making efforts to bring people together. When Jesus talks about the nations, when he talks about race, when he talks about God's love for the Gentiles, that's when they start plotting to kill him. That's when they chase him up a hill and try and drive him off a cliff. Think about that. Like the same thing happened in this country to the prophets who spoke out against the evils of racism. Jesus was pushing back against broken systems, and the system pushed back. All right, just food for thought there. We'll see what ends up happening to Jesus. But after all this, this big scene that Jesus caused, they're leaving the city the next morning, and there's that tree again. Now, Jesus has an opportunity to teach the disciples, and right on cue, Jesus says something that might feel strange. Peter says, hey, look, there's that tree. It's that cursed tree. And Jesus responds saying this, have faith in God. Jesus answers, truly I tell you, if anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea, and does not doubt in their heart, but believes that what they say will happen, it will be done for them. Like, Jesus is weird sometimes, right? Like, first we got this weird thing with the fig tree, then this random flip out in the temple that apparently is not so random. Now Peter asks him about the fig tree, and Jesus gives him a seemingly random answer about faith and a mountain, like completely out of left field. So what we usually do with this verse is we take it and we bring it completely out of context and we think to ourselves, oh, isn't that a nice thought that if we just have faith, like, I can move mountains and throw them into the sea. Like, whatever my problems are, like, if I have faith, I can deal with them. Like, I can do anything. I just need faith, right? I can deal with any of my problems. I just need faith. Like, that alone, that would be a pretty inspiring passage for this sermon series, right? You're like, oh, yeah, Pastor, that really moves me. I love that verse. Like, I'm that's in my list of memorized verses. But like all other passages in the Bible, it's embedded in context that actually gives it its true meaning. So what's really happening here? Well, the passage from Isaiah gives us a clue, doesn't it? Isaiah wrote, these foreigners, these I will bring to my holy mountain. Did you catch that? He's going to bring them to, I'm going to bring them to my holy what? Holy mountain. See, geography is actually important here. I've never been to Jerusalem, as I mentioned, but Mike will tell you, and others who have been there, the temple sat on this big old hill. And as Jesus and his disciples are leaving the city, they're not walking on flat ground, they're walking down. They're descending a big hill called Mount Zion. So when Jesus says, if anyone says to this mountain, go throw yourself into the sea. He's not just saying, if you have faith, you can throw a mountain into the sea. No, it's much more significant than that. He's not talking about just any mountain here. He doesn't say a mountain. He says this mountain. The one they're standing on, the holy mountain, Mount Zion. Jesus is alluding to the fact that change is coming. Worship is actually about to change. The temple that sits on this mountain where the nation of Israel has worshiped for centuries is about to be replaced. Not by another temple, not by another location, but by Jesus Christ himself. I was never actually moved by the idea that faith can move a mountain. I was like, oh, that kind of sounds like a weird spiritual platitude. Like, to me, it sounded like fluff, like a nice idea with no teeth. But the Jesus that we see here in Mark is a Jesus that is not messing around. And that moved me as a young 20-year-old. As a young man, I saw here, it was not only a Jesus who was like dead set on bringing people together, but a Jesus who turns to his disciples and says, you too. You're in this with me. You're on this mission with me. And we forget that kind of easily, don't we? We avoid that pretty easily because it's hard. It's costly to do life together, especially with people who are different from us. We already saw that they started looking for ways to kill Jesus when he brought the Gentiles in the temple. They're like, we can't have that. So they start planning on ways to kill him. Jesus was announcing a kind of change that people didn't want. A lot of people didn't want. Powerful people didn't want. He wanted people, his community, his worshipers, to be the church of the nation. But people didn't want to adapt to that kind of change. And ultimately, Jesus' anger in the temple wasn't enough to tear down the dividing walls that existed between nations. The price was a lot greater than just Jesus getting mad, right? The cost was going to be his life. And we see that happen just four chapters later in Mark. And look what it says in Mark. With a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last. And listen to this. The curtain in the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. Did you hear that? Like, we hardly ever think about that, but it's a beautiful moment, an event that represents that there's no longer any division between us and God, between us and each other. No division between priests and worshipers. No division between men and women. No division between Jews and Gentiles. The temple system was broken down in the death of Jesus. And access to God was open to all. Mike, you guys can come on up. The death of Jesus, the same death that the chief priests and scribes began to plot as Jesus advocated for multi-ethnic worship, people being together, it was that death that makes it possible for us to do this right now, for us to be together right now, Jews and Gentiles, black and white, Chinese and Filipino, Mandarin speaking and English speaking. The event of Jesus' death on the cross makes this worship that we do together not just a possibility, but a mandate on our lives. And we see at the end of Scripture, Revelation chapter 5, with your blood, it says, you purchased for God members of every tribe, every language, every people, every nation. Every nation was purchased for God at an infinite price. So that all people together could be worshipers together. And Jesus paid the price so that we could move like a mountain of segregation that exists in our communities and in the church, sadly, and say, no, 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 no. Jesus died so that we could be together. Jesus paid the price so that we could worship together, so that we could do life together, so that we could love one another. That's why a passage like this moves me. I hope it moves you too.